You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. Since 2017, China has imprisoned more than a million Uyghur and other Turkic Muslims. The plight of these indigenous peoples is well documented, but nonetheless subject to much disinformation. After initially denying the mass internment of the Uyghurs, Beijing subsequently claimed that it placed them in vocational training centers and de-radicalization camps as part of a counterterrorism and poverty alleviation program. But leaked Chinese government documents and the reports of those who've been interned in these camps and have managed to escape China indicate something far more sinister: a systematic campaign to forcibly assimilate Uyghur Muslims into the dominant Han Chinese and communist atheist system. Many have called this an attempt at cultural genocide. In this episode, we'll take a deep look at the systems of coercion, surveillance, and collective punishment imposed on the Uyghurs. And we'll look at how you, the listener, may be consuming products, including clothing and electric vehicles, made in part through forced Uyghur labor. Our guest today is Nuri Turkel, an Uyghur leader who was literally born in a re-education camp decades ago during the Cultural Revolution, and now tragically finds millions of his people scattered across China in these camps and forced labor sites. Mr. Turkel is an Uyghur American attorney, author, foreign policy expert, and human rights advocate. He's a commissioner with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and a longtime leader and advisor to Uyghur diaspora groups. He's also the author of No Escape: The True Story of China's Genocide of the Uyghurs, which I highly recommend to you all. Click on the link in the show notes to find more information on his book. Mr. Turkel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So I want to begin with your own life story. As you write in your book, you were born in a Chinese internment camp amid the Cultural Revolution. I'd like you to talk to our listeners about the context of your birth, both in terms of the internment camp and that moment in China's history.
First of all, I wanted to begin by thanking you to help me to shine a spotlight on one of the worst humanitarian crises that the international community has experienced since the Second World War, the ongoing Uyghur genocide that is in its seventh year. I came to the United States as a student in August 1995 from the Chinese-controlled East Turkestan that is officially known as Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. And I was hoping to restart my life just like anyone else, any immigrant who came here looking for an opportunity and, most importantly, freedom. Somebody who was born in a Red Guard Chinese Communist re-education camp, internment camp, I never thought that I would be talking about that experience as much as I have been in the last 5-6 years, with the hope that that kind of bitter memories, torturous experience should be put behind and never talked about. But here we are. I mean, I've been explaining to people why I named my book No Escape, what prompted writing a book and telling my stories from the time that I was born in re-education camp. That bears a lot of similarities of the modern-day concentration camps that the Chinese set up. We're talking about the camps, the collective punishment that the world has not seen since the Holocaust era. The reason that my mother, who was at the time in her third trimester, taken into the camp was because her father, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was a Uyghur nationalist who wanted to be, wanted to contribute and wanted to have this simple, very admirable desire to have a political freedom for the Uyghur people. And the other reason that they took my dad into the labor camp. Newly vetted couple were forcibly separated. My dad happened to have two cousins in Soviet Union, today's Uzbekistan. So guilt by association, foreign connection, ideological deference to the Communist Party. There are pretty much the same, some of the same reasons that they rounded up around 3 million Uyghurs in the modern day industrial skill concentration camps that Pentagon official put it out in 2019. So she was, my mother was very hopeful at the time that she will get released and deliver me in a normal, under normal circumstances. But the guards kept her in the prison and subjecting her to physical and emotional and mental abuses. So she got injured during that time. And she gave birth to me in September 1970 while she was still injured, recovering from injuries, wearing a cast waist down. After I was born, we end up being still in the camp. So this was September 1970, and we both got released the following April. So that makes it I end up spending my first several months of my life in the re-education camp with my mother. Because of that background, because of that upbringing, because of that experience, I always had this natural resentment against the ruling Chinese Communist Party. During my childhood, adolescence, even after I graduated from high school, went to the regional capital to study Chinese and then the inland Chinese city to attend college.
Right. And the Cultural Revolution was a particularly tyrannical period in China's history that swept up not just Uyghurs, but touched all peoples in China. And the Cultural Revolution lasted from 1966 to 1976. And over that 10-year period, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, were killed and cultural artifacts were destroyed. One of its key elements was the destruction of the four olds, old customs, cultures, habits, and ideas, especially religion. And so many mosques, monasteries, churches were destroyed. And re-education through labor was a big feature of that era and remained in the Chinese system even after the Cultural Revolution. So after China opened up under Deng, maybe to a large extent it was used toward drug offenders and others. In 2013, the practice was banned supposedly, but it has effectively been revived in terms of in its use against the Uyghurs. So I'd like you to help our listeners understand the role these labor camps play in the Chinese totalitarian system in terms of both thought control and brainwashing. What is this idea of reform through labor camps?
This is one of the main tools that the Chinese Communist Party has in its toolbox from that time. And you remind me something that I need to mention, that this genocide, the current re-education program that they call it, is essentially a new type of method on steroid with the same purpose as you perfectly articulated. This is against the Uyghurs' identity, the ideological and ethno-religious identities. So the re-education essentially means they put you through what's called patriotic re-education program, as I profile in my book, and is part of a daily routine in those camps. So they make you to recite slogans like "There's no God but Communist Party," "Everything that we have in this life is indebted to the party, and we should love the party." And in my book, I quoted one of the camp survivors. She even forced to say things like, "Who is your new God? Xi Jinping." So the Communist Party inherently fearful of a religion, particularly borrowing their own term, foreign religion. Foreign religion to them is Islam and Christianity. So they figured out that the Islam and Christianity in particular are incompatible with the communist ideology. And they come up with also something very disturbing. It's almost like a Minority Report type of approach. If the party realize or identify anything that potentially can spread the vital organs of the state that need to be cured. So these re-education is essentially human re-engineering. Even in the year 2022, after the world has learned and woke up to this brutal reality that the Uyghurs have been subjected to, Chinese ambassador to France said that the Taiwanese people are intoxicated with a separatist ideology by the current president, Tsai Ing-wen. And once the Taiwan and mainland China is reunified, Taiwanese people must be re-educated. Even they have this plan for people who are living in a vibrant democracy in Taiwan. So this is the general approach. They try this with the Tibetan community. They've tried this with the Hui Muslim community. They have tried this with the Catholic community and an underground Christian community. But when it comes to the Uyghurs, they connected this fear to national security. Conveniently, the Uyghurs happen to be Muslim. Since 9/11, China has been claiming that the Uyghur identity, Uyghur religion must be tackled. They must be sinicized. Become a family member of this Zhonghua Minzu, that means Chinese people. That way they can prevent the resentment, opposition, upheaval may stem from this distinct cultural and religious identity. They also believe that Uyghurs' ethno-religious identity is global because they are connected to the Muslim population around the world, Turkic people around the world. If you look at the Uyghurs' homeland, they sit in a very strategic area that has about 600 miles international border that includes Afghanistan, India, Russia, and it's a gateway to Central Asian, Eurasian resources, natural resources, and also provides easy access to Eurasian markets. On top of that, since 9/11, U.S. presence, and then withdrawn from Afghanistan, made the Chinese, starting 2015, that the extremist groups might regroup and attract the Uyghur fighters, and they will cause... This is all like, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy. They're creating enemies and collectively in the Uyghur people, thinking that something need to be done in order from something else possibly from happening. So this is all fits into this official narrative, preemptive policing. This is why they ramped up. We will get into the technical aspect, the technology aspect of this genocide. But they're using technology, they're using slave labor, they're using the Chinese economic statecraft, they're using its global diplomatic influence, even to silence Muslim majority countries. So this has been a very well-planned, orchestrated, and adequately and very effectively carried out genocide that has officially started in August 2016 and is still underway.
So there are a lot of elements to this, but I would say perhaps the most prominent are the ethnic dimension and the ideological, that the communist system in China is hegemonic and doesn't allow space for other religions and ideologies, and for Muslims, for Christians, for Buddhists who hold to their own belief system and do not put mortals above the supreme power, the Almighty, that is something that the CCP finds, at least under Xi Jinping today and among many of his predecessors, it's an anathema in terms of the broader population. And then there is this ethnic dimension in terms of the Han Chinese supremacism. And so Uyghurs are regarded as backwards, lazy, abnormal, and sick. And part of that supposed sickness is the belief in religion. And in Tibet, in Uyghur regions, these labor camps and this system of coercion amounts to what is, many call a quote-unquote civilizing project. And so there is a push for uniformity, within a Han Chinese and communist framework. Now, I want to get into this current campaign against the Uyghurs. It essentially begins in 2014, and it's known as the Strike Hard campaign. Now, China has framed it as a counterterrorism campaign, but this framing really lets China off the hook, right? It absolves the Communist Party state system of its own violence against the Uyghurs. Isn't that the case?
Yes, that's precisely the point. Simply put, anyone can imagine a country with a million and plus terrorists and what kind of society or country that it may become. So the Chinese claim in of itself is self-defeating. The way that they name Uyghur homeland Xinjiang, it's essentially a new colony. It demonstrated that it's a colonial power and occupying a landmass as big as the Western Europe, four times as of California. So they can say all those things to justify even claiming that they're fighting against three evil forces. And some of this is a kind of a hallmark of Shanghai Cooperation Organization that Russia and China initiated and becoming increasingly important and big, a large organization with the admission of India into the fold. So the way that they even making assertion that someone has extremist tendencies is also murky. All of the methods, tactics, and even the justification that they're using is kind of opportunistically crafted to scare people. For example, those who are sympathetic to Uyghur people, whether it be being former Soviet colony or Muslim people being ruled by authoritarian regime or dictatorship, or those who have been subject to religious persecution. So it's a scare tactic. So whenever you mention, especially after 9/11, they were so effective. They got a couple of Uyghur organization, specifically East Turkestan Islamic Movement during the Bush administration, designated as a terrorist organization. That has been revoked by former Secretary of State Pompeo in November 2020. That is a significant blow to the Chinese global disinformation campaign that it is repressive policies are aiming at fighting terrorism, which is a legitimate concern. And also Secretary Blinken, to his credit, through a 60-minute interview, said United States government does not believe that believe in the same concept of terrorism as the Communist Party does. I'm paraphrasing his word that your listeners can go and listen. So the Uyghurs' ethnic identity, religious identity, have been perceived as not only sign of disloyalty, but potential threat. At the same time, it has provided the Chinese a kind of ammunition in a public discourse, in the diplomatic arena, that they are dealing with a terrorism, which is debatable based on even in the rhetoric. They claim that, oh, there have been a lot of violent incidents. Yeah, we have read about it. I've read about it. But the fact that the Chinese saying that three times does not make it true, because even if there was some violent incidents took place, no independent journalists, no independent international organizations or investigators allowed to investigate what really transpired. So the some journalists, some policymakers mistakenly taken what the Chinese said at face value and kind of echoing the Chinese propaganda, even to this day. But in reality, that the Chinese fear is the Uyghur ethno-religious identity and their deep interest in the Uyghurs' homeland that sits in the large oil reserve, natural resources, and now in main hub for solar panel and EV battery production.
And given the nature, the opaque nature of the Chinese system, a lot of these claims are just simply unverified. And even if we take them at face value, so for example, there was these stabbing attacks that took place in Kunming in the southern Yunnan province in 2014, they were attributed to Uyghurs. What the official Chinese narrative doesn't acknowledge is the fact that You know, just months earlier, there were peaceful protests by Uyghurs that were crushed by Chinese police forces, and at least 15 Uyghurs were killed simply for protesting against the closure of a mosque and the arrest of an imam. And so state violence in this most obvious form, and also in the general state of siege, is a big part of this picture. And so in terms of discerning the truth of the matter, to simply look at the, let's say, what may be the symptoms of this problem is not a serious approach or a fair approach in terms of addressing a real solution. And so the official Chinese narrative is very self-serving. It paints themselves as victims and the Uyghurs as simply ungrateful and barbaric people. Now, this Strike Hard campaign is unlike anything that China has seen in decades. And the most horrifying aspect is the rounding up of more than a million Uyghurs and other Turkic Muslims into internment camps. But I'd like you to talk to us about the broader system that is established. They include these neighborhood watch committees, the Becoming Family programming. This is something that is truly totalitarian in nature, right?
Absolutely. As you accurately pointed out, the CCP launched what's called Strike Hard campaign against violent terrorism. Their aim is to further systemizing restriction on the Uyghurs' civil liberties. Even back then, the Chinese already had a strict surveillance being put in place, monitoring every movement you make, every communication that you make. But in 2016, it got really ratcheted up under this person by the name Chen Zhengguo, who was a Communist Party Communist Party secretary in Tibet. He got promoted and given this prestigious seat in the Chinese Politburo that essentially sets the agenda for the party and giving him all the resources. And based on the New Yorker piece, A Future Story, he set up a command center in an old Soviet-style hotel, and living and working from that location, monitoring everything that is happening. And then in early 2017, he, with his directive, the local legislator put out something called de-extremification measures that essentially criminalized 48 behaviors, as Foreign Policy magazine translated and published, that includes adhering to certain lifestyle, abstention from sex, alcohol, some, you know, strictly adhering to Islamic and Muslim diet, and also preventing or even advising your children not to marry Han Chinese people, not to drink in public. That kind of very basic behaviors were folded into this punishable crime, 48 types of extremist behaviors. And then around that time, Xi Jinping himself, based on leaked documents, what's known as China cables, called for all-out struggle against terrorism, infiltration, separatism. And he used the terms such as organs of dictatorship and showing absolutely no mercy. And then his henchman, Chen Zhengguo, that some people liken to Adolf Eichmann, and Chen himself, has been sanctioned under the global Magnitsky sanction during the Trump administration. The Chen himself has actually said, round up everyone who should be rounded up. And he also went on to say that his government, during the time of rounding up people, we're talking about 3 million at the time, his government publicly said, break Uyghur people's lineage, break their roots, break their connection, break their origin. At the same time, he directed the centers, those centers, quote unquote, teach like a school, be managed like a military, and defend it like a prison. So this is like a very well-planned and orchestrated a way of collective punishment. And then on the outside, to your point about this family, American scholar Darren Byler was on the ground investigating the so-called Becoming Family program. He wrote a very long a future story on this. Essentially, 1 million household members out, husbands in this case, and 1 million Chinese in. I profile this story of a former teacher, camp teacher in my book, No Escape. In it, she told me that those so-called becoming family member shows up, drink and eat, and engage in a sexual assault while husband is in the living room while she was cooking. And I also have seen and heard from the camp survivors and the witnesses that there was a specific actions in those homes when they were engaging in this intrusive behavior to sexually assault those ladies whose husband taken to the camp, and also using the children during their stay to spy on their mother or father or parents if both parents were present. So this is one of the several tactics that they use to punish Uyghur people. A State Department official in early 2021 correctly and accurately said that Chinese government has created an open-air prison-like environment for the Uyghur people. To the numbers, you know, people always say 1 million, 2 million, sometimes 3 million, but the Pentagon said this is 3 million. But if you look at the Chinese white paper, it specifically said, I quoted this in a number of essays that I've written, 1.3 million Uyghurs and others have been subject to re-education since 2015. And this white paper was published in 2019. If you look at it, the peak of that rounded up was actually 2017 through 2019. But this white paper said already that 1.3 million Uyghurs annually since 2015 were subject to re-education programs. And the other thing that also important to mention, United States government rightfully focused on those Ukrainian children taken to Russia when the determination made that Putin is committing crimes against humanity. But what we're looking at when it comes to the Uyghur children is, based on New York Times reporting, 800,000 to 1 million Uyghur children been forcibly removed from their family members and transferred into another group or state-run orphanages that they've been bragging about in TikTok short videos.
So among the leaks that have come out from these Xinjiang files include these photos of prisoners, Uyghurs who have been detained in these internment camps. And they include elderly men, middle-aged women, even young people. And so this is a war, a total war against Uyghur society. And it's an invasion of the mind, of the body, electronic devices, of the home and of the household. And then there is this panopticon that is established. Mosques are fitted with cameras. Phones are infected with spyware, this clean internet security soldier spyware that monitors one's activity on the phone and then also deletes content that is not permitted. And then, as you had noted, perhaps one of the most unfortunate and harrowing aspects of this is essentially the mass kidnapping of Uyghur children and the attempt to break the households and literally, as one Communist Party official said, break their lineage. And that is, and we'll get into this discussion in a bit, but that is quintessentially genocidal. If one wants evidence of genocide, that quote itself, I think, is sufficient.
Yeah, just to your that excellent point, former deputy national security advisor, who is a fluent Chinese speaker, Matt Pottinger, often says, "Don't listen to me. Don't listen to those policymakers. Don't listen to even activists. Just listen to what Xi Jinping and his henchmen have been saying." That is a policy. That's what they've been delivering. So it's not that difficult. You know, some governments hide, but when they hide their intentions or plans for other people, but Xi Jinping has been telegraphing publicly, quite comfortably. So every time when he delivers speech, there's some catchphrases and he has managed to deliver them.
And especially in terms of the domestic discourse, there's no diluting of any of the sort of, there's no real attempt to make it politically correct language. And so Chinese diplomats may try to water things down and frame it in simply in counterterrorism terms when they engage Western actors or even in the Muslim majority world. But I mean, there's a big reason why China fails at public diplomacy in many respects, especially in terms of trying to convince Western audiences, because of this immense gulf between what it says at home and what it tries to say abroad. And it points towards how very different the Chinese system is and the rights of individuals in that society. The state and the party fuse together and they take precedence over everything else. And so individual rights are really non-existent there. And so to speak to Western audiences, they really have to stick to a script that is ultimately ineffective in terms of speaking to real people and having real conversations. Now, you had mentioned a key player in all this, Chen Jiangguo, who had served as the Communist Party secretary in Tibet before moving on to Xinjiang, the region that is administrative region that is known as Xinjiang. And in Tibet, he implemented this grid-based surveillance system, a neighborhood surveillance system. He had begun the settlement or pushed forward the settlement of Han Chinese in Tibet. And he repeats that same strategy in the region known as Xinjiang. And then there's also the labor camps that were applied toward the Uyghurs. Those are now being applied towards the Tibetans in Tibet. So I'd like you to talk to us about the connection between the Uyghurs and the Tibetans, because there seems to be a lot in common in terms of their own experiences and how they're treated by the Chinese state.
Years ago, when I was a law student, the International Campaign for Tibet, the ICT is the acronym, where Richard Gere serves as a board chairman, was putting together a book about Tibetan struggle. And I was asked to contribute and addressing this very question that you asked me. What is the similarity? What similarity as far as the concerns by Tibetan and Uyghur people as far, and also the policy implementations? I would say this. The Uyghur homeland, East Turkestan and Tibet, have been testing ground for one another. They implement one policy specifically, for example, starting with the railroad connecting the Uyghur homeland to inland Chinese cities that help the central government to dilute the Uyghur population. In 1949, when Uyghur homeland was delivered to Mao Zedong by Stalin, the Chinese populations were about 4 to 5%. And now I think it's more than half in a very conservative estimate. So that railroad connection brought in a lot of Han Chinese migrants to the Uyghur homeland. And then seeing that worked out, they built railroad to Lhasa. That also helped to bring in migrant Han Chinese to the Tibetan communities. The other thing is the language policy. They banned the Uyghur language in the education medium. It worked. And then they implemented in Tibet. And then targeting religious leaders, imams in the Uyghur case, forcing them to distort the religion, phrasing the CCP leadership in the sermon, you know, saying things like, you know, whatever the government says we must do, even in our religious belief, it's a distortion of religion. And it to the extent it worked. And then they take the same method to Tibet. And Tibetan monks are still going through to this day the political indoctrination and patriotic education programs, forced marriage. Tibetans were subject to that kind of government-arranged marriage between Tibetan and Han Chinese. And now they strictly implementing it, very aggressively implementing it in the Uyghur societies. Same thing also with the children. They took the Uyghur Tibetan children to places like Lhasa, Lanzhou and Beijing and Chengdu at very young age. It worked and they turned out to be a Tibetan looking Han Chinese. They took the Uyghur kids to inland Chinese cities with the mindset of transforming them to normal human being, as you pointed out earlier, to the Chinese leadership. Non-Han Chinese people are not normal people. And then finally, in the technology, Chen Jiangguo, actually, the surveillance, some people kind of gets it in a wrong order. The technology started, the surveillance started in inland China with this social credit system program that Chinese people kind of fooled into believing that it's going to make their lives easier. in fact, that helped the Chinese government to collect personal data for AI research and developing some of the most sophisticated surveillance techniques and equipment. And then they took it to Tibet. The surveillance, with the rise of self-immolation, they implemented that policy and the strict surveillance of Tibetan communities. And then it worked, and then Chen Chengguo took it to Urumqi and literally morphed it up. And now the Chinese are in the process of exporting. Secretary Blinken delivered a speech in summer 2022 on China. He mentioned that 80 countries around the world have either adopted or in the process of importing Chinese surveillance technology. So at that point, I'd like to mention something, why this is so important. That when we talk about like TikTok, where we talk about ZTE, TikTok, talk about Huawei, people think, oh, it's a technology, our social media companies do similar things in a very intrusive way, to the extent that's true. But what the Chinese government doing is very disturbing. For example, in my book, I profiled in the beginning of a young man, a European Uyghur, who got caught up and detained while he was in the in those the detention facilities being interrogated. Nearby a machine printer spot out a long list of individuals need to be arrested, and this was in the Xinjiang papers, the leaked document. So the conversation goes along the lines of, oh, we got another batch of names. How am I going to find that with a very colorful language? And then the other one said, oh, we must find those people to meet the quota. And then the list was included 20,000 people. And then the police were scratching their heads, screaming, cussing at each other, claiming that we only have 16. How do we find the rest? And then they were forced to find 17,000 people, the Uyghurs, in just 10 days in one country alone. And the irony is that when these police were shockingly did not even know why they were arresting so many people. And later we find out that these are all done by AI algorithm. So this is sound like a cartoonish, but those people cut off in an AI algorithm is because because what they said, how they communicated, what they shared in platforms like WeChat. In an app called Zapier. It's a Silicon Valley developed app that was designed to transfer or share a religious materials, like verses of Quran in Arabic. So the technology was a key player in initial process of rounding up people. And what is happening today? In addition to exporting and normalizing this level of surveillance, the Chinese are developing what's called brain control weaponry that the Commerce Department added to the Commerce Department Bureau of Industry Securities entity list. It's essentially export list, not export ban. So this particular app or tool was developed by the Chinese Military Medical Academy and its 11 affiliates, with the purpose of controlling the mind and behaviors of the ethno-religious groups. On top of that, they also have been engaging in a population optimization programs. So they are illegally taking DNA samples from the mothers, even telling the mothers if they see anything that their babies are not in line with the standardized population of this great nation. Therefore, they need to go through abortion. A Washington-based think tank reported in 2019 that at least 75 out of 176 countries are actively using AI technology. And of those 75 countries, 60 of them are using the technology linked to China. And 50 of them are supplied by Huawei, that our government imposed export ban, which is a giant tech. There's no company like Huawei in the world, which is essentially The Chinese government claims that it's a private entity, but it's essentially a combination of Pentagon, FBI, CIA, NSA. There's no such a thing around the world. So they are pouring in a lot of money. They are in actively, aggressively collecting personal data through those exportation of technology and equipment. They also have access to that host country's data system. One key example, interesting example, is that Chinese government offered to build African Union's the headquarters in Addis Ababa with the architectural support, design support, interior design, equipment, furnishing. And then later they find out that somebody in Beijing have a direct access to all the communications taking place in the African Union's headquarters. So this is a kind of, this gives you an idea what we're dealing with. Not only that's been developed, tested, refined, or perfected, and now exported, but it is also potentially a huge threat to our liberty, freedom, most importantly, privacy. Once you allow the Chinese technology to get access to your personal information, no one knows how it can be used. And personal information, data, is essentially oil to engine when it comes to AI research. So it's we're in a very, very critical period. So when people talk about these concerns, I ask you to pay close attention, but there's a serious concerns, threats against civil liberties, privacy, and democratic norms at home and abroad.
Right. And surveillance capitalism is obviously a problem here, but surveillance state capitalism is a whole other ballgame. And it's far more dangerous in a totalitarian system where there are no individual rights, there are no checks and balances. And the Chinese system is literally says it wants to control minds and has taken clear action to do it. And now it has the technological capabilities to invade people's minds and find out what they're interested in, what they think, and what they believe in ways that are unprecedented in the history of man. And as you noted, you know, what goes on in China doesn't stay in China. So Chinese officials often talk about how they don't want to interfere in the systems of other countries. We can debate whether that is the case, but they do export their technologies. And when those technologies are exported to other states that have a similar absence of restraint on how the state can investigate and violate the privacy of individuals, then that reflects a de facto spread of this kind of China model, even if those countries, those ruling regimes, have their own reasons for using these technologies against their own citizens. And then, you know, going back to the question of the Tibetans and the Uyghurs, you know, what they also have in common is that, you know, these are two communities. These are the among the largest ethnic minorities in China, and they have a deep connection to their religion, and they live in regions that are far flung and quite large in geographical scope, and they have distinct identities and national aspirations. And so they're in many ways outliers in the Chinese state, and that was why there is this fierce campaign of forcible assimilation. Now, the United States government and many other Western governments have come to the assessment that China's treatment, its policy over toward the Uyghurs since 2014, amounts to a campaign of genocide. Human Rights Watch and the United Nations term it crimes against humanity or potential crimes against humanity. I'd like you to detail how this Strike Hard campaign constitutes a genocide, and what exactly is the end state that the Communist Party of China desires, let's say, 10, 20 years from now?
I know that the word, G word, the genocide, has been invoked more often than not in the last few years, in number of instances, you know, starting from the Rohingya atrocities against Rohingya people, the Yazidis and the Uyghurs. The legal definition under the Genocide Convention specifically states that genocide occurs, specific acts are committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And that intent element can include conditions of life that are calculated to eventually destroy the group that has been targeted. So why do I mention the intent? You know, just like any criminal case, you have to present or there has to be actus rea, the act, specific act, and mens rea, the intent element. So no one disputes the act that we have been seeing, reading. Even United Nations under the leadership, United Nations Human Rights Council under the leadership of former Chilean president, Michelle Bachelet, recognizes the crimes against humanity. Crimes against humanity is actually, to the extent, legal a little bit more stronger than genocide because there's no specific acts through the court can be taken in a situation like this because China is not a party to any treaties like Rome Statute and all that. So they don't recognize international court. So it's very difficult. But when you look at specifically why this meets this requirement, essentially boils down to three things. One, the condition of life that are calculated to eventually destroy that Uyghur group, breaking the lineage, roots, and connection. And then the second element is the purposeful, deliberate prevention of natural population growth. According to the Chinese own statistics that several scholars have written in extensive reports, a birth rate, natural birth rate in the Uyghur region, specifically in the heartland, Kashgar and Khotan, Kashgar is my ancestral, my place of birth, plummeted by 60% from during the period of 2015 and 2018. Across the region, the birth rate plummeted, falling nearly 24% in 2019 alone. And comparing to nationwide decline, that is 4.2%, and 24% is much larger and significant drop. So that is a very important factor when initially the State Department and looked at it, if this is the Chinese atrocities amounts to genocide. So that's one important factor. And this meets one of the key legal definitions of genocide. The third element is the separation of children. So based on Chinese government's own public documents and statements, they did separate it and remove the Uyghur children from their family members to inland Chinese cities and to Chinese families, to the state-run orphanages. And also something very, very disturbing that it is even hard to talk about today, that the violence against the marriageable Uyghur men and women. Taking men to the camps, taking women to the prison when at their optimum age for having family, having children. So the forced labor is one of the key aspects of this genocide because of it is very, very carefully and very cleverly designed way of separating men and women. Whom otherwise would establish families. So that's one important aspect of, and then more specifically, they're using modern day medicine, giving medicine as my, as the individuals that I, the camp survivors that I profiled, Mihrigul and Kalbunur and Tursunay Ziyavudun, they were injected a mysterious drug that prevented them from having a regular period. So these mysterious pills and injections given in the camp, and that's some of the most common practices. On Ambassador Samantha Power's first week on the job, I was asked to put together a meeting with her and Uyghur community. So I asked one of the camp survivors to come and talk to Ambassador Power, who is now the administrator for U.S. Agency for International Development. After we met, that meeting's supposed to be off the record. Samantha Power tweeted and says something along the lines of, so many women, Uyghur women, are not going to be mothers. The world cannot go on without mothers. That was the response from a meeting originally meant to be a private meeting. So, and then the male individuals also going through forced sterilization. So they're doing this through medicine, through incarceration. And most disturbingly, one of the individuals that I profile in my book, Kalbunur, a former camp instructor, told me that even though she's getting the age, getting close to the age of 50, and naturally not in the position, barred some miracle happening, that she could be able to conceive. And yet they force her to go through forced sterilization. So the evidence, and also all of this information, it's not something that the United States government cooked up where some ambitious journalists write a story telling a sentimental, reporting sentimental stories. This is all Chinese government open source provided information. And if you read the initial State Department statement that was made public in January 2021, it goes to very specific details, and much of them points to the Chinese source, the Chinese government's own bragging. They did the same thing about the camps as well. They even showed before and after images of places that they built that was independently verified through tech-savvy individuals. They also showed or published the procurement documents seeking companies to take part in this massive prison system that they're building. So everything has been out in the open. But what has not been so acceptable and to the extent disgraceful is that one out of 156 countries that are member that are signatories to the genocide 1948 Genocide Convention, only 10 governments and parliaments have formally recognized this is genocide. The definition, a legal definition, is provided under the Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, but the Article 1 is equally important that specifically mandates that the signatories need to call it out, stop it, and punish. So those significant enough number of countries have not even been able to fulfill their treaty obligation to bare minimum, at bare minimum, to call it out. We're not at the a stage of punishing, but we're at the stage of stopping still. Because it has been only few democratic countries, that includes Taiwan. Taiwan has been pointing gun at them for decades by CCP government in Beijing. But they were courageous enough to recognize in its parliament that this is a genocide. So this could have been in a very different place if there has been a kind of international outcry that international community has shown to the plight of the Ukrainian people.
So 1 to 3 million Uyghurs were reportedly rounded into these camps. What do we know about them today? Some appear to have been sent home. Others have been sent to these labor camps or factories across China. Do we have any reliable figures now about where things stand now in terms of the Uyghurs who have been detained and put elsewhere?
No one knows exactly what happened, but we do know that vast majority of those detained have been placed in three different places, if you add the children, four different places, starting with the concentration camps that we were told that we've been aware of having that many people. Just to, you know, give you an idea, in Washington, D.C., we have 750,000. The population of Washington, D.C., District of Columbia is 750,000, around that number. But if you just look at the 3 million, it's literally four times the size of D.C. population are gone into those camps. So after they initially rounding up that many people, so they looked at those have a serious ideological problems that includes authors, publishers, religious leaders, influential thought leaders, social elites, they are sending them to prison camps that includes family members of American citizens, specifically some of those journalists work at the Radio Free Asia and whose family members been detained because of their social influence and academic accomplishments and being sent to the prison camps. That includes doctors as well. And then the second type is younger ones who can be used in the slave labor camps. So they are transferred into manufacturing sites, assembly lines in adjacent places in some instances through internal labor transfer, transferred into inland assembly lines or manufacturing sites. And then the last one is the hardcore, what they call the extremists. So they have been still languishing in the camps because they cannot be released. They cannot be sent to the prison because sending them to prison possibly be allowing them to get access to the family members. And they also cannot send them to the labor camps. So those are the ones are, I believe, in the most uncertain circumstances. So they will be, and we've been reading news that some old people, based on the another leaked document released in some early summer 2022, that there's some elderly people, including the mother of the World Uyghur Congress, Dolkun Issa, died in the camp, and she was over 80 years old. So some of those Uyghur detainees that the authorities determined cannot be reformed will remain to be continue to languish in those concentration camps to go through that human reengineering. And then the last one is the children's detention facilities. The number of reports been published. When Canadian government acknowledged its past mistake with the treatment of native indigenous children, the hope was that that might energize policymakers to hold the Chinese authorities to account for those massive number of kids, but not much has happened. So those, and then importantly, relation to those individuals disappeared. Chinese government has been also engaging in something called transnational repression, TNR, on our soil in the United States and around the world. So the method that they've been using, one, a smear campaign that if you go to public and claiming your family members disappeared, taken to the camp, you end up going to meet with the parliamentarians or members of Congress, giving media interviews, they're smearing those people as liars. And then the other type is that other type of method that they're using is to just directly reaching out to them to tell them to essentially be quiet unless that person wants to see additional family members taken to the camp. And then in my own case, because I have been so outspoken and I have played both government and non-governmental work advocating human rights for people who have been criminalized, mistreated by this criminal regime. If you committed genocide, you're a criminal regime. That I have been sanctioned by both Xi Jinping's China and Putin's Russia. In April 2022, while I was in Uzbekistan, my father passed away. And I was in a neighborhood. Those of you who have access to a map, you can check it out, that Uzbek capital, Tashkent and Urumqi is essentially the same distance between New York to Washington, D.C. And yet, even though my dad passed away on my arrival to Uzbekistan the same day, around the same hour, I could not go and hold my mother and pay respect to my father who raised me and give me everything that he had, including his blessing to send me to the United States with his life saving in 1995. And then to make the matters worse, that mother that I told you earlier, I am smiling through the tears right now, give me birth and put suffer so much, has not been able to see me since summer 2004. It's almost 20 years since last time I saw my mother, and I don't even know if I will see her again. There is a exit ban on her. President Biden, Secretary Blinken, Ambassador Burns in Beijing, and number of senior officials in our government have asked the Chinese to let my ailing, aging mother, who is 73, suffering diabetes, heart disease, and Parkinson's disease, to go and come to the United States to meet her grandchildren, whom she hasn't had a chance to meet yet, and be with her American family. And Chinese are essentially just letting her to rotten, just borrowing her own words. They're waiting her to die. So it's ironic that my mom asked me one time, if I committed any crime being your mother, being subject to this punishment, how long is it going to take for them to realize that punishment is enough? Is 20 years considered enough punishment for a mother who is longing to see her children? My mother have four sons. Two of us are here. Two of us are in Europe. Has 9 grandchildren. She had only met 2. So that gives you an idea and how brutal this regime has been, even to people like me, who is an American citizen. American U.S. trained lawyer, have a very healthy professional life, and yet something very, very fundamental to be able to embrace my mom, my parents before today, and take them to the hospitals when they're sick is something taken away from me. The entire Uyghur community, it makes me very, very upset to say even the level of harm that the regime caused to Uyghur families, including my own, is irreversible. The family time that they have taken from us, including those who have been taken to the camp, including those who live in the same city but cannot see each other. One is in one camp, the other is in another camp. Just like my dad was in a labor camp, my mom and I were in the re-education camp when I was born. This enforced family separation on a massive scale is simply intolerable. So the entire Uyghur community has been going through collective trauma.
And the Chinese state is a state that separates families. It is a state that does not forgive. And for you and for your own family, it has been so cruel. And in your case, you've experienced that cruelty even before you came into this world. And so it certainly says something about your own relationship with that state. And you know, if this is a government or a country that wants to supposedly have harmony between all its peoples, this is absolutely the opposite approach that it should be taking. And, you know, on the subject of elderly, the elder folks who have been caught in this net, this wide net that the Chinese state has cast, there was a 96-year-old Imam, Abidin Damalam, who just in February died in prison. A 96-year-old man has no business being in prison. He's no threat to society. But I think what it points towards is what you had suggested earlier. There are a lot of these individuals who the Communist Party feels it can't afford to let out because they may be able to speak. And so in terms of those objectives over the longer term, sadly, it appears that there's a hope for a slow death of many of these individuals who have seen quite horrible things and have the potential to speak out. Now, I want to get to the question of the use of forced labor, because as we've established, the idea of forced labor is a fundamental tactic of the Communist Party system in China. But it also becomes something that impacts us all, because China is now an export powerhouse. It's the world's largest trading country, and it essentially is the factory to the world. And it's linked to so many different supply chains. So even if the end product is not necessarily made in China, its constituent elements probably have or likely to have some kind of Chinese hand involved. So I'm wondering, in terms of this Uyghur forced labor, what industries are believed to be the most exposed to it?
Thank you. This is something that keeps me busy and keeps me hopeful at the same time. Because now, because of that connection to everyday life, because it's connection to American and global investors, and it's also connected to our future, emerging technology, green technology, that makes me believe that this is something that eventually people will get it right. But simply put, forced labor is a cancer on our values. I wrote an essay on the day that President Biden took office, highlighting my own experience, and essentially urging the incoming administration to do take meaningful actions, which they did. There's a very powerful law, Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, that bans products made in the Uyghur homeland in part and whole getting into our bedrooms and our bathrooms and our garage, kitchen, our roof, cars, medicine cabinet, based on the programmatic reports being published by Sheffield Hallam University in the UK by this expert, Laura Murphy, that literally every industry has been tainted. Initially, it was a cotton sector that was one of the main tools for this government entity, a paramilitary unit called Xinjiang Production Construction Corps, that controls the water resources, controls the cotton fields. So 85% of the cotton product produced in China are sourced in Xinjiang, East Turkestan. 25% of the world's cotton supply are sourced in the Uyghur homeland. That gives you an idea how much that the global consumers that use cotton products have become dependent on products produced by modern-day slaves or fellow human beings who have been subject to this exercise. So this is a state a system of race-based slavery program that the Chinese manufacturers, Chinese business owners can order the government to help them to get Uyghur workers. I have seen the advertisements who were forced to advertisement by the Chinese businesses, essentially saying things like, I need a minority workers in batches of 100 to work in factories in eastern China. And there is also, I've seen the advertisement in it, the promise was made by the government to the businesses saying that the transferred workers will be trained with a semi-military style discipline. They will come with a police minder and to prevent any troubles. And then, interestingly enough, the ads also offer a guarantee that the workers will not be job hopping and will not be allowed to leave. So these are the things that initially start with the cotton and then the agricultural product. The second most heavily affected sector is construction. Construction materials, flooring materials, the cabinets. And then the third one is the pharmaceutical or PPEs. In the midst of pandemic, New York Times published a feature story profiling Uyghur workers making masks for global community to save lives. Later, we find out that the Uyghurs also have been used in a pharmaceutical sector making a medicine. So this is part of the reason that the struggle to stop this modern-day slavery is part of the securing critical supplies effort. And then the automobile industry. Automobile industry has also been implicated. and electronics, the memory chips, fancy dashboards, tires, leather seats, all of it believed to be made, reportedly made with Uyghur slave labor. So the oldest on top of all of this, the one piece of information that need to be reminded when you were approached by those companies that offered to install solar panels, you need to ask them if that solar panels are imported from China. If it's imported from China, that the chances of them being made with the Uyghur slave labor is quite high, and there's a documented evidence for it. So just in summary, the supply chain: garment, solar, PVCs, agricultural, automobile parts, and the emerging technologies. So those other things have been in the news a lot, and there have been documented evidence that slave labor has been used.
Yeah, and so it depends on which country you're in, but potentially the tomato in your ketchup, the cotton in your clothing, the aluminum in your car, the polysilicon in your solar panels, all of these could have been produced in some shape or form using Uyghur forced labor. And a lot of this is due to joint ventures that auto manufacturers like Volkswagen have with Chinese companies like SAIC. I even recall a couple of years back, Muji, which is a Japanese apparel company, was actually advertising its use of Xinjiang cotton. And so I was shocked. I saw on its social media feed and on its website, it was advertising shirts that were made with Xinjiang cotton. This was in 2021. And so this is well after this genocidal campaign became known to the world, but it goes to show the power of the Chinese market as well, because Muji sells clothing not just in Japan, in the U.S., and in Europe, but also in China. And so a lot of these companies have kowtowed to China by virtue of not just its power as a manufacturer and source of materials, but also as a market. Now, you talked about the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. It was passed in 2021, and in its first year, more than $1 billion worth of products were intercepted at the border. I'm wondering, in your view, is there more that can be done to prevent the entry of products and material that are the byproducts of Uyghur forced labor, at least in terms of the U.S.? Is there more that can be done?
Absolutely. Starting with the consumers, since we're talking to a listener of your program, the consumers have, in my own perspective, immeasurable power. When we stop buying those products, like my son, at the time, 4 years old, we're walking by Nike store. I told him that I cannot buy a soccer jersey for him, and he didn't understand and explained to him over and over. Now he doesn't ask me to take him to Nike store. He's 7.5, but things as simple as that. I personally stopped buying my work clothes from Hugo Boss. There was this story written about it, and I did not know that Hugo Boss was a company making Nazi uniforms during the Second World War. And I would not purchase Volkswagen. They have been just been tone deaf. I personally have sounded alarm since 2019 when I delivered a keynote at the Oslo Freedom Forum, showing the picture of then a CEO of Volkswagen. And all the others, it's just if you type in and Uyghur Forced Labor Coalition.org, there's a long list of companies that have been implicated. Oddly enough, they cannot go out in public saying that if they have done anything right to rectify the situation. H&M did it, and then they got hammered. And also when Nike said, we will stop sourcing from Xinjiang, there was an orchestrated attack on the company that forced them to take down that pledge. So unless we consumers start getting this message to the corporate executives, investors, corporate board members, it is very difficult to force them to do the right thing. And on the policy level, there are a couple of things that our government and our like-minded partners can do. One is to enhance the existing laws, improve the existing laws, or make the necessary amendment. The Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act that Congress passed in 2021 arguably is one of the most remarkable bill since China joined the WTO that bans goods mined, produced, or manufactured in the Uyghur region unless the importer can provide with clear and convincing evidence that they're not made with the Uyghur forced labor. The beautiful law, it's a very powerful law that actually making a lot of companies to look into their supplier, the sourcers, sourcing companies, but that has not been addressing the problem. In order to make this law more, make this law stronger and achieve adequate implementation, we need to add a criminal consequences. Forced labor is a crime. It is an international crime. It's a corruption. We have Forced Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that goes after corrupt business practices, bribery in a corporate environment. Why can't we have something like that to have law enforcement involved in this? That's one. This idea gained traction. I shared this idea in my testimony in Congress March 2023 last year before the CCP Select Committee, bipartisan committee. And also the other thing that need to do is we need to have our like-minded governments in Asia, Japan, Australia, Korea, to and in the European Union to have a harmonized approach. You're perfectly right that Muji and Unique Law are two Japanese companies been implicated, and they're still in business, still doing business with the questionable Chinese suppliers. Some of the electronics owned by the Asian companies are still doing business. European companies, Volkswagen, Mercedes-Benz, Siemens, and others in Europe are still doing business. So Europe is becoming kind of a dumping ground because the Chinese cannot bring those products directly to the United States. And also importantly, we need to look at the USMCA, the agreement, trade agreement between US, Canada, and Mexico, to close the loopholes, close the possible entry of those goods through railroad and the highways, through trucking to the United States. And more importantly, we need to continue to add, identify and add Chinese exporters to the Homeland Security's entity list designation, an entity list, which is an import ban, and in tandem with Commerce Department's entity list, which is export ban. And finally, and this is very important, we need to pressure our investors from continuing to invest in our own demise. American consumers, global consumers, American investors, in a way, fueling this genocide, underwriting this genocide, underwriting our own demise. That has to stop.
Right. And it's also worth noting that there's a certain threshold for inspections of goods that come from China. And when you purchase items from these companies like Shein and Temu that send direct to consumer, they fall below that transaction threshold. And so many have recommended that the threshold for inspection be lowered. And I would say that, you know, Americans ought to really reassess and look at how they're addicted to cheap, fast fashion. Because when, you know, Temu sells a piece of clothing for 50 cents, I mean, that is low, below.
De minimis. That's it. The name is de minimis, which is goods under $800 enter the United States without inspection.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, lowering that to another, you know, to some other threshold, maybe in the sort of low hundreds of dollars or something like that, it may be, it's something that the, you know, Biden administration and Congress should consider, because a lot of these cheap goods are simply entering into regular people's households, and people don't care because it's just so cheap. But the price of that is being subsidized, potentially subsidized by forced labor. And I don't think, you know, somebody may wear a nice $2 t-shirt, but it's the cost of someone else's oppression. And I think there's a moral cost to that as well for us as individuals. And so, you know, people need to really step back from buying all these this cheap disposable clothing, because what's implicit in that act is that the people that produce that are also disposable. And I think we need to really have a strong sense of our moral connection to these supply chains that rely on the exploitation, if not the full-fledged oppression of other human beings. Now, a final question. As someone who is literally combating a superpower in terms of trying to maintain a connection with your own family and also resisting this horrific campaign against your people, what is it that keeps you going?
Thank you very much. This is I really appreciate you asking me this question. You know, we talked about a lot of dark, grim. I painted a dark, a grim picture, and apologize for your listeners if they end up listening to this late at night. It's very concerning. It's very, very a grim reality, brutal reality that we've been dealing with. But what motivates me today, every day? Actually, the answer is quite simple. A sense of responsibility that history requires all of us, including myself, to take up. We live in a peculiar period. Every day we're hearing horrible stories, horrible news coming from all over the world. It seems like the world is on fire. And, you know, we have to take up some responsibility and show up and fulfill our own moral and professional obligations. Personally, I don't want to see my children and the others to go through a similar experience that as I have. Every well-lived life must work to better the world for future generations. It's a very futuristic concern for me. Over the years, I have had the opportunity to meet heads of states, prime ministers, cabinet secretaries, members of Congress, luminaries, and I even shared the stage with some of them, and I helped to pass laws, visited a lot of places. I travel around the world, and I get inspired by those support, including being able to speak to the listeners through this program today. So all of it boils down to one simple word, hope. I recently learned that somebody, some wise author, said the hope is a discipline. So, and also before this, I always reminded myself a wise word of late Senator John McCain. He often said that the hope is the best weapon against oppression. So it's very difficult to speak up in the situation that I find myself. And specifically, when you deal with this kind of brutal regime, the gratification is that we've made so much progress from nothing to even being able to pass laws. It's been horrible, and it's been very, very, very painful, to say the least. And because of that hope that I keep myself up every day, and I always speak up. Even at a very heavy personal and professional cost. I have no choice but to continue to speak up.
And that was Nuri Turkel of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice, and thank you for tuning in.